A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey guys, you ever wonder what Phil and I wear while we podcast? You can find out if you join our Patreon. We'll also be talking about the films of 1989, but that's definitely less important than seeing our Zoom backgrounds, our headphone choices, and our sweatshirts.
It's true. You'll get to see all the various pieces of artwork that I have framed on my office wall, and you can see Kenny's garden, sort of. So that's something. That's exciting.
It's a hanging garden.
But perhaps more important than anything, we are doing this Patreon to cover the best films of 1989. Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Indiana Jones, The Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, with amazing guests like Tom Meissen, Liz Hanna, Joanna Robinson, Brian Cogman, Chuck Hayward. You can sign up at patreon.com/podcastlikeit's1989. And for $5, you'll get access to all the audio of these fantastic episodes. For a few bucks more, you'll get video as well of our 99 and 89 episodes. And perhaps, most importantly, you'll be supporting us so we can just keep making podcast content for you guys.
Hello and welcome to Podcast Like It's 1999, the podcast where we talk about the films of 1999 from a dinner table enjoying a perfectly normal pastry here in 2021. I'm one of your hosts, Kenny Nybart.
And I'm Phyllis Gove.
And with us again is the pod whisperer, the guest who made it all right to change our opinions. Mm-hmm. Rochelle Lefebvre, thank you for coming back. So excited to have you.
So excited to be here.
I don't know how you're going to change my opinion on this one unless you change it downwards.
Yeah.
Is that possible? Ah, this because I'm afraid I cannot do.
I loved Titus, and it was the best, and it was the most exciting film I've watched in 2021, I think. What a fucking thrill.
Kenny
Wait,
sent me
did you see it originally in 1999 or any time?
I've never seen it. I've never seen the play. I've never read the play. I had no prior knowledge of the play. And I'm not a Shakespeare noob. Like, I'm a Shakespeare person. I, you know, took several Shakespeare classes in college, but for whatever, I know the reason. No one wants to read fucking Titus Andronicus. So
and no one wants to teach fucking Titus Andronicus.
No. Yes. No one wants to be near it. So like it is one of those plays that unless you kind of seek it out on your own, it can pass you by, which it did with me. And on top of that, like you alluded to, Rochelle, I think in an email, it is his longest play. It does.
Wait, I looked it up. Hamlet is actually, I think, his longest play.
Oh, well, Hamlet.
So this is like second longest.
This is like, it comes close. It ranks.
So it's up there with Hamlet. It's
also not like even Shakespeare people, like Shakespeare aficionados or what have you, don't rank it particularly high in his work when everything is said and done. Not that I didn't love this movie and that I don't think the play is good. I think that there are purists that feel as though this play was him kind of, I don't know, doing something that they didn't think was all that interesting at the time.
It's a far less romantic version of Boy Gets Girl.
Yes, I would agree with you. It is not a romantic movie.
He doesn't have a, well, we'll save, let's, yeah, keyword, yeah, romance. Yeah. We'll go back there.
keyword romance.
But I was, and the other thing is I was not particularly looking forward to this one. It looked like homework, obviously. But it's not. It is a breezy 2 hours and 45 minutes. So.
But truly, I actually do agree with you, Kenny. I saw this film in 99 in the theater, and I remember being pretty blown away by it. I quickly bought the DVDs when they came out, and I thought it was great. But I have not seen it since. So I was like, oh, right, this movie's almost 3 hours long. How's this going to hold up? You know, all of that. It moves. Like, it does not feel like it's almost 3 hours long. Part of it being the performances, and obviously it's a you know, incredibly well-made movie, but just like, it moves.
Yeah, it also has, I can't think of another one right now, and you guys are way bigger movie buffs and nerds in the most reverential way, I use that word, about film, so you might be able to think of one, but I can't think of a movie this long that doesn't have like a stopping place where you're like, oh, I'll watch the rest tomorrow. This seems like a good place to go to the bathroom. And the reason that I know this is because I tried really hard to turn it off, because I have these young kids who have the fucking nerve to wake up so early in the morning. Right. And I started it at 8:30 at night. And I was like, well, I'll just watch half and I'll watch the other half tomorrow. And there was no point in this film where I was like, this feels like I could go to sleep now. This feels like I could get a good night's sleep and then watch the rest tomorrow. So I just watched the whole thing through. I couldn't stop.
I do. It should be said. I got a panicked phone call from Rochelle when she pressed play on this doc, which was amazing. She calls me and she's like, I pressed play, but I don't know if this is the right movie. And I was like, what do you mean? And she's like, well, there's like a kid and he's playing with action figures in a kitchen.
Yeah,
I was like, that's how it starts. She's like, okay.
It was like a weird 80s. Yeah, it was like, it started like a weird 80s dystopian movie.
And then a bunch of people in a Coliseum and you're just like, what?
Yeah, what? And I saw it originally. And loved it and thought that I remembered it. And I had completely forgotten the device of the like anachronistic young Lucius. Yeah. I had totally forgotten about that. And I panicked. And I also only had those one or two nights to watch it and then no other time scheduled. It's not like a movie you could just kind of slot in in the middle of the day. So I freaked out.
I thought it was the wrong movie too, because it looks like something out of like Pink Floyd The Wall video.
It looks a little bit out of that
I Hate Mondays video. You know the song?
Yes, sure.
One of those British. We're gonna get bombed again. Movies.
Yep.
And the guy who comes in and grabs him out of the kitchen looks like a lost extra from like Mad Max Beyond the Thunderdome.
Totally. It looks like Bane or something. Yeah.
He felt like a Brazil character. It has that kind of crazy Gilliam energy too.
Totally.
What is happening? And then he holds him up and
And then you get a really, I would argue, perhaps too long credit sequence of the various soldiers. I love the movie too, but I just thought it was, there's two moments. It's ironically the bookends of the film where it does feel as though you could have shaved off about a minute or two from a child walking into the sunset for what feels like eternity, and also the credit sequence, which, you know, I like credit sequences.
So I have thoughts about that. I've thoughts about everything.
As you should. That. We expect nothing less.
Yeah. So the beginning and the end, where you feel like you could shave off like a minute and a half on each end, right? And get 2 minutes and, you know, 40 whatever minutes instead of 2 hours and 40 whatever minutes.
That's right. Yeah.
So I thought about that because I had that instinct too. And it was interesting. I had two things. Well, I had the instinct of like, this is going on for too long. And then I also had a voice in my head that was like, you're wrong, Rochelle. You're wrong. Go sit in the corner until you know why you're wrong. It was Kenny. And I think I figured it out, which is, as we know, Julie Taymor, like the theatrical, right? And she's honoring the theater. And I think that there was a couple of things. Number one, it isn't soldiers marching, it's dance. It's choreography. Mm-hmm. It's beautiful choreography. And once I gave over to the idea that a film needs to earn my butt still in my seat every second, theater doesn't have that sort of pretense, right? Because in film, you do other things. You eat popcorn. If you're at home, you can go to the bathroom. Yeah. They're like these other activities. Theater is where you sit your ass down and you shut up, which, note to people, which is what movies should be as well. If you go out in public to a film, please do that. But there's an expectation that you just want whatever is being offered. Right? It's not like, oh, this is like, I'm on my couch for two extra minutes here. So I love the choreography element of it. And then I think the end is, it was so long, but I needed to catch my breath. I needed to let the movie settle. And I just did that while the movie was still going, instead of turning it off and doing that on my way to the refrigerator for my, you know, next meal, because now it's been 3 hours.
Mm-hmm. I think that's completely fair. I'm speaking more to the ending than the beginning, because I agree with you, the choreography is beautiful. It really highlights as well, it's a computer generated effect on top of everything. So you're just sort of like, you're really soaking in the technical, not great technical sort of aspect of what you're watching. So it's just sort of like, I don't disagree
with
you.
Maybe you were.
I'm sorry?
I wasn't. Okay. I mean, I was, you know, because I was, I sent Phyllis a shot of my face.
It was amazing.
At the end of the movie.
So it was an amazing photo.
Because I really, that was my genuine face. And then I held it.
I can't believe you.
And then I held it so I can take a picture of it and send it to you.
But I want to see it.
I'm going to show it to you. I needed time for my face to die down. I needed at least 5 to 10 minutes. Here you go, Rochelle. That's how I looked like at the end of the movie.
That is amazing. That is so good.
And that really was cemented in place for a while. So really, I needed all the muscles in my
face
to relax.
This movie, I often we've talked about, and I don't know who originally said it, but the whole "wow them in the end," you know, idea of a movie of like, wow your audience, leave them in sort of like a holy shit place if you can. This movie does that. This movie definitely, when you think about that dinner scene, this movie really just kind of, it goes for broke. It's amazing.
It does. But I if I was designing the poster, I was like, what would my tagline for this be on the poster? I decided it would be an eye for an eye until there are no eyes left.
Yeah.
You're just sort of left. God. Like,
it's an amazing, you know, the thing that I think is interesting too is, there's really, I mean, any good people within this play are either murdered or basically murdered. Like there really isn't any good people that win in this movie. Yeah, although, well, I guess you can make the argument
Lucius Jr.
Correct. Lucius, why am I drawing a blank on the son who Lucius. Kills Alan Cumming? Is that Lucius? Is that his name?
Lucius is the only surviving son.
Lucius goes off to lead the Goths and comes back and kills.
Lucius's.
Yes. But then the crazy thing is that apparently in the play, when he gives the speech at the end about the various burials of the various people, there in the original text, there's an allusion to him having killed the child, the child of Tamara and Aaron, and apparently convinced Julie Taymor to not do that because he felt as though the character was the only hope.
That's interesting. I totally disagree with him. Can we get him on the phone?
I agree with you.
Because I think that like the survival of the child is that the cycle continues, right? Because that child has to come back now and kill Lucius to avenge the death of his father, Aaron, in such a terrible way or at all. And so it just like violence begets violence. And it's just a mise en abîme and the film ends and the mise en abîme is still going.
I don't disagree.
Yeah.
It's weird. It's like, well, it's also sort of, it's an interpretation thing, right? Which is that some people can interpret the ending of it as that this child will break the cycle, right? And that this child won't seek revenge, and that perhaps there's hope in these future generations. This film does not seem hopeful. This play does not seem hopeful. So to kind of tack on a somewhat hopeful ending feels antithetical to the play itself.
Well, it's momentary. Right. Sure, it's just momentary. It's just when they decided to end. Obviously, this wasn't a present day set play. I think Shakespeare knows that the cycle of violence goes on and on and on and on.
Yes, correct. Yeah.
But or Shakespeare or Julie Taymor. It doesn't really matter who it is. I think if there's one thing we've shown throughout history is that we will keep avenging deaths until there is no one left.
Yeah, that sounds right. I think there's something interesting too in terms of, I want to give a little bit of context for this film very quickly, but it's an adaptation of Shakespeare's Titus Andronicus, an epic revenge tragedy of brutal savagery based on Roman times. Titus the general returns to Rome victorious, decides to sacrifice the son of his enemy, the Goths, to appease the Roman dead after the queen of the Goths pleads for her son's life to no avail. She sets out a mission of retaliation that leaves few of the participants unscathed. It was adapted and directed by Julie Taymor. It opened on December 24th in a limited release against Stuart Little, Toy Story 2, Any Given Sunday, Bicentennial Man, and The Green Mile. It would go on to make a little shy of $3 million on an $18 million budget. It's got 68% from critics, oddly, on Rotten Tomatoes, and 86% from audiences. I think what's interesting, too, about this film is it's a Fox Searchlight film before Fox Searchlight, not before, but sort of in the early days of Fox Searchlight. And, you know, it was obviously sort of what's the last moment we can release this film in limited release in the hopes of getting Oscar nominations and perhaps making some money in January or February. It doesn't really get any Oscar nominations. I think the only nomination it gets is for costume design. The costumes are phenomenal.
I didn't get a nod for cinematography or art direction. Which I know it didn't get a nod for directing, right?
And it didn't get a nod for any of these performances, which is crazy. Yeah. Like, how does Anthony Hopkins and Jessica Lange not get nominations is kind of baffling to me, if nothing else. I mean, the whole cast is stellar. Harry Lennox in particular, who plays Aaron, is unbelievable in it. It's very odd to me that this film was completely ignored on the Oscar front. Do you, Kenny, do you have thoughts on why
it's not,
that was?
What's odd to me, I mean, it's odd in retrospect because it's such a brilliant film, but what's odd to me is 68% on Rotten Tomatoes.
That's
the thing that I in the moment, people didn't think this was a good film, or at least, 68%. That essentially is, a mass ignoring of this film, which is what happened. I do remember this film having a bit of a build-up, a bit of a lead-up. People were somewhat excited. These are obviously Oscar-winning actors in Anthony Hopkins and Jessica Lange, and it's a really deep cast. And I do think sometimes Shakespeare's bench gets people excited. I remember 3-4 years before, people were very into the Twelfth Night adaptation. Mm-hmm. So I would Much Ado About Nothing. I mean, again, talking about plays outside like the 6 or 7 that get adapted all the time.
And the other 99 one, Midsummer Night's Dream, has a tremendous cast too, right?
Tremendous, like these casts, that
also directed by Julie Taymor, right?
No.
She directed a Midsummer Night. There's a she directed some.
She might have done one.
Maybe they filmed
this one.
This one was
Michael Hoffman, I believe, did.
You're talking about the one Stanley Tucci
as Puck. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes.
And that's another one that, that's a pre-sold title. Titus is not.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes.
And I think that, I think what really surprises me is that it seemingly was ignored by critics. If this movie had, I'll put it this way, this is the movie that I wish got the topsy-turvy love and kind of had that slot, because there was a slot in 1999 on best of lists for a movie like this. Now we're talking about, obviously, literally 800 years of British history when you're talking about what can fill that slot.
Sure.
But it seems like topsy-turvy is the one that people kind of glommed onto, and this was utterly ignored. But this is super affecting to me, brilliantly conceived.
Sure.
One of those Shakespeare adaptations that makes you feel like we haven't even scratched the surface of what to do with this material yet. And that's exciting to me too.
I want to just quickly read Roger Ebert, who actually really loved this film, gave it 3.5 stars. He was one of the critics that was sort of really clamoring for it. He says, so bloodthirsty is Shakespeare's Titus Andronicus, the critics such as Harold Bloom believe it must be a parody, perhaps Shakespeare's attempt to settle the hash of Christopher Marlowe, whose plays were soaked in violence. Other readers, like the sainted Mark Van Doren, dismiss it out of hand, inhuman, unfeeling. He called it, and no tragedy at all if pity and terror are essential to the tragic experience. This is exactly what Julie Taymor has done in a brilliant and absurd film of Titus Andronicus that goes over the top, doubles back, goes over the top again. The film is imperfect, but how can you make a perfect film of a play that flaunts its fall so joyfully? Some critics have sniffed at its excess in visual inventions, many of them the same dour enforcers who didn't like the biblical surprise in Magnolia. I've had enough good taste and restraint for a lifetime, and I love it when a director has the courage to go for broke. Julie Taymor is the director of the Broadway musical The Lion King, which is one of the most exhilarating experiences I've ever had in a theater. In her first film, she again shows a command of costumes and staging, ritual and procession, archetypes and comic relief. She makes it clear in her opening shot, a modern boy waging a food fight with plastic action figures, that she sees the connection between Titus Andronicus and the modern culture of violence in children's entertainment. Titus would make a video game with the tattooed Tamara as Lara Croft. I don't know about that. There is no lesson to be learned from Titus Andronicus. It's a tragedy without a hero, without values, without a point, and therefore as modern as a horror exploitation film or video game. Anyone who doesn't enjoy this film for what it is must explain how could it be more. This is film Shakespeare's play deserves, and perhaps even a little bit more. I think I never saw Lion King on the stage. Did you guys see Lion King on the stage?
Mm-hmm.
I've seen it twice.
It is what he says it is.
I can only assume.
I saw it in the mid 90s when it came out, and I saw it a couple years ago with my kids.
And what was that experience like both times?
It doesn't hold up, but in the mid 90s, it blew me away. I mean, right. There's nothing like it.
And when you say that, because I know that like this film has flourishes for sure, and we'll talk about those. What was so sort of earth-shattering, if you will, about her stage of The Lion King was the physicality of it, the visuals of it, the costumes, the way that she sort of brought it to life in this sort of, I want to say surreal to some degree or another way. Would you say that like that was what was so impressive about it, or one of the things that was so impressive about it?
You want me to go? It's basically... Yeah, what's so impressive about it, first and foremost, is the costumes and the puppetry.
Okay.
It dares you to suspend your disbelief in a way that plays are always daring you to suspend your disbelief. But usually it's easy. There's a history of 1,000 years or plus 2,000, 5,000 years where people are meant to accept what's happening in front of you on the stage as real life.
Sure.
But instead of doing something that's cheesy or ugly or weird, like having people in lion suits or having people not in costume like that at all, there's beautiful, elaborate costumes that meld with the performers' bodies in a real natural way and are incredible works of art on their own and never feels clunky or weird or uncanny valley-ish. And the performance is like being able to like perform at a Broadway level while also puppeteering these elaborate puppets is kind of amazing in and of itself. And then The Lion King rocks no matter what. I mean, I'm Cole. My 4-year-old is in a Lion King phase right now, and the songs just never get old. They're incredible. So I think the
Can I add to that? Well, I was going to say in terms of like. What she did with The Lion King, like for the costumes, which is one of the things I think she does in Titus, like you can see this sort of theme with her, I was so struck because one of the things I'm used to, I've seen so many Broadway musicals, like I love them. And one of the things I'm used to, particularly where actors are playing characters who are, super fantastical, either not sure. human or my light just went out. You guys will you obviously. Oh God!
I don't even know.
You couldn't even tell.
I'm used to the sort of costume fully covering the person in a way that you just don't have to think about it. And there's no way to see the person underneath, right? If it's a tree, they're a tree. If they're a dog, they're a dog. And what she does is there are so many costumes where there's the actor, the human body underneath, you know, either all in black or like in some sort of leotard type covering. And then there's the costume on top, so much so that there's this beautiful dance where the masks go up and down. They're sort of like on these hinges, or I don't know how she did it, but the masks go up and down as the characters, you know, as the actual performers sort of bow their heads and come back. So they are constantly moving their bodies in a way that they're working the choreography of this costume that moves with them rather than their face being the, you know, the face. And what it does that's so striking is, I think you said it well, Kenny, like, you know, she's okay with the fact that you're going to suspend disbelief. She assumes that you know you're in a theater and that as immersive as it is, unless you're having a psychotic breakdown, you're not going to forget you're in a theater seeing a play, right? You know, like, and she embraces that theatricality and that that relationship. And she does it in Titus, where, especially at the end, right, where she does this beautiful, the tableau of the dinner taking place in the Colosseum and showing the audience. It has a very sort of Sleep No More quality where you can see both the audience and the play, where she just constantly uses it to her advantage that you know that what you're watching is you as an audience member watching a work of fiction. She did it beautifully in The Lion King, and she does it beautifully here.
And that's part of why I love her so much. And I do love her, and I think she's brilliant. I would imagine as she's putting these shows or movies together, there are a lot of people who are doubting and naysaying because they're so inventive. And they are, you know, when you're, Rochelle, you're talking about the people's faces versus, you know, what's happening with the puppet, they're giving two distinct performances at the same time that have to kind of dance with each other, right? If you watched, for instance, if you're watching The Lion King and you only watch the performers' faces, you'd get a performance. You'd understand what's happening with the show. They're not trying to hide, right? There's not camouflage going on here. Meanwhile, if you only watch the puppet, because there's some who are actually doing puppets with their hands, and there's some who are wearing these elaborate costumes that are like puppets, you get another performance that also was satisfying and also felt, you know, important. And what you're normally doing, I think what everyone's doing, is you're watching both. You're kind of marveling at what's happening in front of you. But I would imagine as she's putting these things together, there are people saying, doubting her every step of the way. And she must get so fucking exhausted being like, just trust me. And the thing is, she's right. As Griffin Newman has said on his podcast, and it's true, The Lion King Broadway musical is the most successful entertainment property of all time. Period. End of story. Audiences went along with it. You know, audiences, and there are always going to be the naysayers. There are always going to be the doubters. There are always going to be the people who say, well, I can see the performer right there. And they can go jump off a cliff as far as I'm concerned. And anybody who can't get down with a movie like this, for instance, I'm just throwing this out there because there are motor cars in it, can also jump off a cliff. Yeah. You know,
well, I think it's interesting because you've hit on something that I think is, because Julie Taymor's career in filmmaking, not in the theater necessarily, has been, I don't want to say bumpy, but she has notoriously locked horns with producers on basically every movie that she's done. And she hasn't done, unfortunately, that many of them. She's done this film. She made Frida in 2002. She did Across the Universe in 2007. She did The Tempest in 2010. And then recently last year, a film called The Glorias, which is about Gloria Steinem, which Amazon just kind of...
It was just that was a TV movie.
It was Amazon. They just kind of unfortunately dumped it. You know, the probably the most notorious is our Frida and Across the Universe, of which she... her and Weinstein did not get along on Frida, which I think could have been a brilliant film. I think there's a lot of wonderful stuff in it. I quite like what's there, but it does, you do sense that there's shenanigans going on, you know, on set and in the editing room. And then Across the Universe, she also clashed with Joe Roth at the time as well, in terms of that film. I think Across the Universe is actually a beautiful movie.
Yeah,
I think it's a great movie, and a movie that does not get the love that it deserves. But I agree with you, Kenny, which is just get out of her way and let her do what she wants to do, because she's obviously a genius. And it's crazy to me that there is the pushback that
I think
that
you
there
know
is.
Why.
I mean, unfortunately, I think that her gender probably has a lot to do with it, unfortunately.
And listen, I obviously support this notion. It's true. And I don't want to diminish it at all. So we'll let that stand alone. But I would also like to add to it that there is this there is a nice tradition in filmmaking where producers will hire a director who is extremely unique. They've seen their other films, they know what they're signing up for, and then they want something completely different. You know, and then they let them get on, they get on set and they go, "Wait, what are you doing?" And it's like, didn't you see the thing where I did the, you know, the trippy thing in the background with the who do you think you hired? Why didn't you hire the other person otherwise? So this is
it
also
never,
just something
it never
that
ceases
happens.
To I couldn't agree with you more, and it never ceases to amaze me. Did you read the script?
Right.
You know, did you read the script, you saw the scene, you knew it was there, and then did you just think, "Oh, well, I'll fight them on this later. I'll get them to cut it later." Or did you just not think that I was going to shoot it? Like, I don't understand.
Right. Did you spend the 4 months of pre-production working up the courage to talk to me? Like, what's happening here?
Hiring Julie Taymor is a choice. Yes. And it's not, she is not a journeyman director for hire. She is a artist with a very specific vision. If you think you were just going to put from the creator of the Lion King musical on your poster and then get the biopic of Frida Kahlo you thought you wanted, then you don't understand who you're hiring. And I think that this does, you know, like, again, going back to Blank Check, like, this seems to be the story with Elaine May. And this seems to be the story with Julie Taymor. And if there's a, I'm, you know, again, I'm not necessarily the right person to ride for this, but I do think it's important to point it out. If there is a female director whose vision requires money, then they always seem to be pushed back to the point where they say, "Go fuck it. Go fuck yourself. I'm not going to even make movies like this anymore." And you miss out the opportunity to, for instance, a guy, and now he won Oscars, obviously, but a guy like Oliver Stone spent 20 years of his career without anybody pushing back at all. And sometimes you get movies that are horrific that way, and sometimes you get movies that are brilliant, and that's the gamble you're making. That is the game you are playing. That should be the same situation with a director like Julie Taymor. But my sense is the kind of people who would finance her movies and produce her movies, your Joe Ross, your Harvey Weinsteins, just didn't understand that.
Well, I think it's also just to very quickly, I on the DVD, there was a making of. It was about an hour long documentary about the making of the film, where you obviously get a real sense of what she is like. And the reality is, she doesn't suffer fools. And she fucking knows what she wants, and she's going to get what she wants. And I think, to your point, Kenny, unfortunately, these men in this business, most of them producers, although she did clash with Anthony Hopkins, and I want to get your guys' opinion on that in a second, in terms of a very sort of a linchpin of the character. But it's she digs in her heels and she stands her ground. And you can really sense that in this documentary, as she should. She's the director of this film. She has a vision of this film, and this is the way that she wants it. And I think that a lot of these producers, mostly men, have just thought that women know the role and will back down, and she just won't. And I respect the hell out of it.
I'm not going to continue with that point, because I think you've both said it very, very well. And I don't feel like, just because I'm a woman, I have to like weigh in some other way. I think you've done a really, really great job of making that point. What I want to add is how it's received as an audience and the critics. I also have to question how that's received, knowing that it's directed by a woman, because not to be reductive of either film, but both Titus Andronicus and Kill Bill have a strong revenge porn element, right?
Sure,
and
for sure.
When a guy like Tarantino makes, you have a visitor. Makes revenge porn, everyone wants to go on and on about the minutiae of his genius. Right. Yeah. And when a woman makes a revenge porn film, it's given like the best. 68% says to me that they went, "This is as good a film as she could have made out of this material, but there's room for someone else to do better."
Yeah.
And I don't want to turn your podcast into, you know,
you're
a lecture
right.
about misogyny or sexism in if audiences or critics. But
if you have a lecture, this is the podcast to do it.
This is true. This is true.
I think because, I just gave it.
Because where the fuck else are you going to do it? One. And
you know what I like to do it, Kenny? When my husband comes home from a long day of work. That's when I like to do it.
Well, give the guy a break. Do it.
Yeah, right?
Give it to our audience. Come on. I feel like if that's what's on your mind, and if that's what's relevant to the reason why this movie wasn't appreciated in this time, I think that is valuable. But
I think it has a little bit of it was made by a dude. I think it gets a little more of an audience going, fuck yeah. That's what I think.
Well, I agree. I think that this first of all, this movie is, this movie's violent and crazy. Like, it's not as though this film is you know, I don't adhere to this idea, but that you could, you know, paint it with it's feminine or it's soft or it's something along those lines. Cause this film is not that. Like, this isn't the type of thing that you could, you know, that you could say, well, you know, clearly a woman directed this, quote unquote, if that was something that you wanted to do. So I don't even really think that it fits into that box. What's interesting about the Anthony Hopkins thing is, so they disagreed about Titus's mental state throughout the production. Julie Tamer felt that Titus is faking his madness to a certain degree, but that he is actually mad himself. Like, that he has lost his mind, but that to some degree he's also faking it. Whereas
Hopkins, in mad with grief, as they say?
Well, yeah, I mean, yes, in terms of, like, there's a turn, which we'll get into with Lavinia, where you could conceivably say that he breaks to a certain degree and that from that point on, it's just revenge, and that's all he has. And it's just a sort of a spiral of madness that kind of continues from that point on. Hopkins felt that Titus is completely faking his madness and that he's completely sane. Where do you guys land on this in terms of the reading of the character?
I have an answer, but Kenny, if you want to go.
You go ahead, Rochelle. I don't have an answer. I have a question after.
Okay. I guess I agree with Anthony Hopkins.
Interesting.
I do agree with Anthony Hopkins, but I might be in the middle. I don't disagree that there is a mad with grief, that there is a turning point, that there is, that, like, you know, our brains are for survival and some cognitive dissonance is required in order to go forward in certain circumstances, right? Like, some compartmentalization. And so after what happens to Lavinia, after poor Lavinia goes the way of poor Philomel, then I do think that there is something in him that snaps or breaks or whatever the word is. I'm just not sure that it's madness in the sense of the way that you sort of take leave of your faculties. I think it's grief stricken. But I also think the element that makes him mad and sane at the same time is the idea of a character who has nothing left to lose. And that is a kind of madness, right? The sort of like, the sort of falling down type break where it's like, you know, I'm just going to go falling down. I see myself as someone, whether how the outside world sees me has no bearing. I see myself as someone who has nothing left to lose. And I know that the only satisfactory ending to my story is death. Mm-hmm. Well, and that is a place where he, I feel, arrives at.
For sure. I think that Hopkins seemed, again, I was not there. He seems to be searching perhaps for something a little bit more binary than I think.
That's what
Julie
I was gonna
is.
Get at. Yes.
Yeah. I think that Julie sees it as a more fluid sort of situation. And I think he wants to lock into something that's black and white. And sorry, Kenny, go ahead.
Well, now I disagree with him. If that's how you're framing
it. I want to ask you something, Rochelle. Because this disagreement, this conversation cannot exist in a vacuum.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
They're making a film together. But in your opinion, Rochelle, what control does an actor have over the interpretation of his or her role? And what interpretation does the director have over that role in concert with, in this case, her larger vision for the film? And just to kind of backtrack just a little bit onto something Phil said earlier, my feeling in general is making a film is not really all that different from building anything else. In that, if you were building a table and someone said to you, the left front leg should be 3 inches shorter, that doesn't work, right? Even if it looks better or feels better or whatever. If she has a vision for this movie, this film, and it needs to be, you know, calibrated a certain way, I do think she has the authority to say, I want it performed this way. Now, that might be from that might be informed by where I sit during most productions. So, Rochelle, what's your feeling about that?
Can I add one other thing to this question, Rochelle, as well? Just because I think it's worth noting just sort of the way you ended that, Kenny, which is we're also basing this off of a play that was written many, many, many years earlier. So there's this interpretation of what Shakespeare had intended to. So there's that added sort of to the mix.
But and obviously, famously, there are so many different interpretations
of everything he ever did.
Is there a right or a wrong? I mean, there are certainly things that feel wrong. All right, go ahead, Rochelle. I'm done.
No, go ahead.
No. I mean, when it comes to Shakespeare's plays, there are option A and option B and options that have never been explored. There are things that may be wrong. Right. I'm not even in terms of like that weren't his intent, like things that may be a wrong interpretation based on everything we know and understand that don't actually work within the context of the larger player, the context of history, or the context of his oeuvre. But these things don't necessarily seem, neither of these interpretations seem outside of the realm of acceptable. Mm-hmm. And my feeling is I would default to the director, but I don't really understand the process that Anthony Hopkins is undergoing here. So you do.
Right. So I would say, so a couple of thoughts. So first, I think it's a really, really interesting question for a film which is based on a play directed by a director who eats in the theater, who, you know, really is just so unbelievably talented in that domain. Because for two reasons. One, the easiest debate, as for people who are maybe, if anyone is feeling a little sort of distance by this, it gets a little inside baseball, you know, if anybody's feeling a little distance, one of the sort of biggest, examples of this that people like to bring up is the idea of the character playing, you know, the audience gets to decide whether Hamlet is crazy or doing all of this on purpose. And it doesn't matter if the audience is arguing out in the hallway, but the actor better know.
Right.
And a lot of directors want to take on Hamlet because they have a strong opinion about whether or not Hamlet is sane or whether he's insane. And they cast an actor who will portray it the way they see it, right? And they want to explore either themes of these sort of grand manipulations or they want to explore madness. I think that it's an interesting question because it comes up in the theater, especially with Shakespeare, and Hamlet is the most famous example that I know of. I think that something that resonates for me in terms of like Anthony Hopkins pushing back and wanting him to be sane is that actors are, you have to have something to play, right? And you can play madness, but there's no agency in that. Mm-hmm. it's not as compelling to watch as people think to just watch somebody be crazy. The same way it's not as interesting, like the reason some actors get drunk and some don't, and that there's an argument made by some of the great acting teachers not to get drunk when you're playing drunk, is because what's interesting is the motivations, the drunkenness just allows, or the madness just allows for the true motivations to take shape, right? It allows what, who is the person really, what's really happening without any control and any of the boundaries and limitations that sanity and fitting into society put on. And so as an actor, the question you really have to be, to answer is not how do I play madness? Because that's not a thing. There's no agency in that, like I said. It's, who am I really and what do I really want? And what am I really doing? And now that the inhibitions and the adhering to societal norms and all of that has been stripped away, what's really coming out? And so it sounds to me like, I don't know, I just, I wonder if there's a possibility that what Anthony Hopkins was, what he, it's so, he's so great. You have to say both his names. I can't say Anthony or Mr. Hopkins. So Anthony Hopkins.
Sure.
Yeah, I just wonder
or
if
Tony
what he was,
Hopkins.
We weren't there, but I wonder if what he was really trying to get at is not that he's just totally fucking mad, but what is this character actually, with an eye still on the end game, right? What are this character's actual, like, motivations, because he doesn't just go mad. He's myopic in his madness. He has a singular focus. He knows, he still knows what he wants.
I love what you're saying. It's unbelievably boring to me when a character is just is just painted as a crazy person or a mad person. For all the reasons you're saying, when I'm in a room and a character's motivations are yada, yada, yada away by saying, well, that person is crazy, therefore they can do anything. I want to run out a window. I just, or jump through a window. We have decided it is unimportant to actually build proper character motivations. We have painted them with a brush that we don't even understand. And have used that to explain why we're not doing our job. So I think it's very different than performing crazy.
Sure.
I think that, but it probably comes from a very similar place.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say that I think what we're all kind of circling here is choices. Mm-hmm. And that as an audience member, you need to feel as though choices are being made to a certain degree, right? That there's that these characters are doing things for reasons X, Y, and Z. And when it feels as though they're not doing that for any particular reason, to Kenny's point, it's not just boring, it's unmooring, and you yourself just being
if
like,
so and so is crazy, right, quote unquote, do the work to show how crazy they are.
Right.
And the reason that it's boring is because it lacks specificity, right? People are not just crazy, right? If someone talks to themselves, you can't play a character by just being like, well, I'm just going to talk to myself all the time, or I'm just going to say weird random shit or I'm going to laugh in the wrong place. That's not how it works. People who talk to themselves hear voices. And I can
not
tell
all of them.
Just as not all
sometimes.
Of them. I talk to myself. I hear my own voice.
That's right.
I talk to my own voice.
Thought to myself constantly.
Which, by the way, is also a kind of crazy. Discuss. But so, you know, you can tell when you're watching an actor who's just being random, as opposed to an actor who knows exactly what's happening on the other side that we can't hear, or a motivation that we can't feel, or that we wouldn't interpret as rational, but to them makes perfect sense. These are the components of madness that have to be really, really well thought out in order for it not to be just random and boring, like you said. And so I don't think that Sir Anthony Hopkins would disagree with us, nor do I think Julie Taymor would. I think ultimately, probably what the reason it never got resolved is they were having a disagreement about something that is so nuanced that you could actually argue about it forever and never make the film.
Well, it's also, you know? All of this speaks to, you know, arguably Anthony Hopkins' best performance, which is Hannibal Lecter, right? Mm-hmm. Which is a character who, you know, was obviously so broken down in you know, within the book and within sort of the science of it. And he was a fiercely intelligent character. Like, I think that Hopkins, it seems, and again, I don't want to put words in his mouth, because I will say that I do see shades of Hannibal Lecter near the end of this film in terms of his performance, in terms of sort of how kind of broadly he plays him a little bit near the end. And once he's either playing crazy or acting crazy, whatever it is, there is sort of this heightened theatrical quality to the way that he's performing Titus that feels a little bit like Hannibal Lecter, that I wonder whether or not he was looking for something similar to hold on to. Who knows? But it seems as though perhaps that was what it was. Here's what I will say, though. In 2002, Anthony Hopkins confirmed that he found this experience working on this film so stressful that he decided to retire from movie acting. So he, for what it's worth, him and Tamer clearly went at it, and he was just like, I can't. I appreciate the Julie one that he retired briefly.
The fiercest fights always seem to happen like when people are this close, you know, like
that's what I'm saying, where you realize that actually we're talking about the same thing, where just you're hovering a millimeter to the left of the net and I'm hovering a millimeter to the right. Those are the worst kinds of conflicts to find your way out of, the hardest.
If either one of them didn't care about this movie deeply, they'd give up. You just give up the fight.
Right.
You just, you know, you go out and do the thing the other person says and go collect your paycheck and go on to make, Instinct, right, Phil?
Right.
So, you never know what he's doing. Yeah.
The thing I wonder, you know what I have to wonder? So, you know, in theater, theater's terrifying for directors in a particular way that film is not always, which is in theater, you can do everything right up until curtain, and then the curtain lifts and your actors go on stage alone. And as a friend of mine used to say, as a theater actor, if I want to go out and stick my thumb up my ass and sing the national anthem, that's what I get to do.
Right.
As a director, your loss and lack of control is utterly complete in that moment.
I love that about
it. And so I wonder if there's for directors who do both or who come up in the theater, I wonder if there's a kind of a holding on, you know, and trying to control it as much as you can until the moment of performance, because it feels like that's where you lose control. But actually in film, you get it back because you get editing, you get ADR, yes. You get reshoots, you get so much control, that actually a lot of actors that I know sometimes just, I've seen things where they're so passionate, but they walk away because they know that ultimately, even if they win the battle here on set, they're going to lose it in the editing room because they won't be there.
Yeah. Well,
so I wonder if that wasn't a factor that maybe, you know, she didn't realize in the moment, or I'm sure there's nothing she doesn't realize.
It's interesting. I totally agree with you. And it's why, I mean, I've been on sets, I'm sure we all have, where, you know, an actor doesn't want to say a line and a director will be like, just give us one with that line. The actor knows.
Oh, the old, just give us one.
The one that that's the one they're going to use. Like, it's you just know.
This is why a lot of the,
sort of resign yourself to that control issue. So.
Yeah, no. And a lot of the reasons why some of the most common arguments I see on set, or that I've had on set, disagreements or whatever, are just the, you know, just give us one. And the actor going, no, because if I give you one, then you have it. There's no such thing. You only use one. And and in that sense, Anthony Hopkins is right. It is binary.
Yes. Yes. Totally.
You know,
I want to dive into the plot because there's a lot to unpack.
I don't want to stop. This is really, really compelling stuff to me. I think that this is a really, you know, interesting, you know, argument in the context of this film, or discussion in the context of this film.
Sure.
That neither of these people have complete ownership over, because it was written by William Shakespeare and has been adapted by many people. They both have just really, really strong opinions about what this film is supposed to be. And it's really making me think of it in terms of directing. In terms of directing and control, and when you see control and when you take back control, I mean, I like to think, I'm not a director and I don't want to direct, but if I did direct, that I'd like to believe I would hire actors who I respect, and I would take what they gave me and then try to build something that I thought was, you know, wonderful out of the pieces I was given. But that also speaks to why I don't want to direct. Because I don't want to make the big decisions, right? I don't want to make the big decisions from, you know, from day one of pre-production. I want to collaborate and have take everything everyone else is willing to give me and get that on film and then make decisions post. Mm-hmm. But there are people like I really think Julie Taymor seems like the kind of person who knows what every frame of her film is going to look like and sound like and feel like before she starts rolling. And I think a deviation from that is probably a bit of a short circuiting. So I think that is kind of where this comes from, maybe. And it, you know, as wonderful as Silence of the Lambs is, and it's one of, you know, the greatest films, Jonathan Demme's not that kind of guy. I think Jonathan Demme takes what he gets and collaborates, and he's a filmmaker. He's been making films from when he was making garbage films. So he was pumping them out in the late 70s.
Sure.
So I do think that's a, you know, the different ways of approaching filmmaking is really, really interesting, and must be difficult for an actor working with all these different lunatics.
I think it's also worth noting too, and you were sort of circling this, Kenny, but you know, this is her first film, right? I mean, she has not directed a film before. Julie has not done a film before. And in this documentary about the making of it, you really do get the sense that she finds it, I don't want to say overwhelming, but there's so many more moving parts and pieces. She even says this on the documentary, in making a film than directing a play. And that it kind of blew her mind how many choices have to be made at any given moment. And I think that, to your point, Kenny, I think it makes it, she's that much more locked into her vision, right? She's not going to deviate from it, especially this first time out.
Why would she?
You know, why would she? So it is sort of, it's kind of a recipe for a situation like the one she had with Hopkins, where it's like, you know, this is how I see it the same way, or at least give me what I'm looking for and let's move on. And I guess I would also say too, you know, the subject matter of this play and movie is harrowing. And I imagine that if you're an actor in this film, especially if you're Hopkins or Lang, you are going to a very dark place. You are going to a pretty nihilistic place. And I think, you know, whatever bearing walls you can find in this darkness, I think is incredibly important. And I imagine it has to be sort of, you know, discombobulating, if you will, when a filmmaker is saying that wall doesn't exist to you. You know what I mean? Right. I imagine that has to be scary. I'm not an actor.
I was actually thinking about that when you said that, you know, I didn't know that that in 2002 he was like, I quit. I'm never doing that. It was so
I quit.
I'm out.
I quit.
Peace out. I didn't know that. And the thing that I was thinking was, you know, well, interesting. But how much of that is actually just a byproduct of going, I never want to feel that way again.
Sure.
And
sure.
It's much easier to relate afterwards to the human experience that was yours, right? Anthony Hopkins was having, as opposed to going, I never want to feel like Titus again. Well, I never have to be Titus again, so it'll be fine, you know, instead.
Right.
Which is not what actors do. And especially not when you're as great as he is and you're fully inhabiting and fully going there. Those are wounds that are going to follow you home. So to project that onto the entire film experience is not something that I think is unusual.
No, I mean, and I imagine that an experience like this, they had 3 weeks of rehearsals before shooting this film, which I guess is, I mean, I don't know if that doesn't seem normal, but it also doesn't seem like it's an enormous amount of time. But they had 3 weeks of rehearsals before they shot it. And then they shot the whole thing most of it in Italy. It feels like a very immersive experience that she was putting them into. And that's, as I said, sort of a harrowing thing to go through. You know, Jessica Lange in particular in the documentary was so sort of eloquent about, first of all, she seemed just plain gleeful in terms of playing this role, right? Like she was just, it is such a vicious, full sort of bodied performance. But she talked about sort of excited she was, but that she felt like even after the 3 weeks, they didn't even scratch the surface of the character. Like that, I imagine that that has to be exciting too, as an actor, where you just feel like there's an ocean of depth. It's all dark and fucked, but like there's a lot going on there. So I imagine that has to be exciting, but also imagine frustrating too, depending on the situation.
Yeah. I think that, and now I'm going to take us off track, but it's tangential. It's not like totally unrelated. But I think that, you know, they had Titus and Tamara are both having experiences that one would like to think Jessica Lange and Anthony Hopkins are not having in their everyday lives, don't even closely resemble.
Sure.
Right?
Sure.
And so as a result, it's so immersive and it's so... Is he agreeing or disagreeing with me? That's all I want to know.
He does not agree with your thoughts on
this. Well, tell him to come to the mic and say it to my face. having an experience that is that immersive, right? And being like, oh, that was so, oh my God, that was sick. It's just, fuck, I never want to go there again. But then when I think about Jessica Lange playing Tamara, there are a lot of things where, yes, this character was so, it was so out there. It was so big and so red and you can't scratch the surface. But every experience that she has is highly relatable and sort of has a little bit of just another day at the office of being a woman. In the way that Titus does not, right? So like the things that happen to him are so beyond the pale that it's like, oh God, right? But for Tamara, let's look at some of the themes, right? Oh, she's a mother who loses her son to the dogs of war, to the men, loses her son to the men who make decisions about war that she doesn't get to participate in, has no seat at the table, but is expected to nobly and almost, you know, and patriotically donate the lives of her sons, right? Sure. And then is whether she will live or die, and how she gets to portray her grief and how her grief is received, dictated by men. Then she has to marry a man she wants nothing to do with, probably loathes and finds repugnant, has to marry him and smile sweetly in order to survive and give of her body in ways to survive, right? And loves her sons, but also always in a strange sort of either overly intimate way because she's holding on to them in a way that is like, in an incestuous clinging, again, because she knows that at any moment she will be asked to sacrifice them and just take it with her tea. And so
I think
there's
she'd be okay with losing those guys.
Well, yeah, you know.
Although she's poisoned that well pretty. I mean, I.
Right, I but if you have kids, but if you bear your children, sure. right? If you have them in your womb and if they are flesh of your flesh and there's all that, right? So I don't know. I'm just saying you can go on and on and on.
My kids wind up like that.
You can go on and on and on, but in a way, Tamara is having an experience that is just what it is to be a woman in the world.
Sure.
And nothing, when I watched it, I was like, oh, Titus, this is so fantastical. And I watched Tamara and I go, there's nothing fantastical about it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that, and this sort of does get into the plot, because I do think that.
Good. We should talk about what happens.
Talk about the plot, but a lot happens. But essentially, Titus comes back from war, brings back his quote unquote spoils, which is Tamara, Queen of the Gods, and her sons, and Aaron the Moor. Titus sacrifices Tamara's eldest son, Alarbus, so the spirits of his 21 dead sons might be appeased. Tamara eloquently begs for the life of her son, but Titus refuses her pleas. She's amazing in that scene. Jessica Lange begging for her son's life is unbelievable. You know, it's one of those ideas of like, you can't equate a life for a life. Titus lost 21 sons. She's losing one. You know, you can't really sort of equate these things, obviously. But war is war and revenge is revenge. And this sets her off. And basically, the machinations of plot being what they are, there are two brothers, Saturninus and Bassianus.
Bassius and Saturninus.
Mm-hmm. Sorry, sure.
I think it's Bassius.
Hey, I believe
it is Bassius, yeah.
Yeah.
Saturninus.
Played by Saturninus is played by Alan Cumming. Bassianus.
Bassianus.
He is played by Frayne.
James Frayne.
James Frayne. Both are amazing. They're squabbling to figure out who's going to succeed the Emperor of Rome, Caesar, and who's going to be the new king. Titus is voted as by the people of Rome as the person to do it, but he doesn't want the job, is the long and short of it. And he hands the reins over to Saturninus. And that moment is essentially the moment that seals everyone's fate, right? Because that's the moment when the power is given to...
Close.
Okay.
If Lavinia and Bassius didn't run away together, then it may have gone differently. I don't think Titus was so blind as to give power over to somebody who was going to try to destroy his family. I think what he thought was that Lavinia would go willingly to Saturninus' side.
Oh, I disagree.
Didn't know that Saturninus was gonna want.
No, I disagree, because they were already betrothed, and actually, Bassius says a couple of times that they are legally, lawfully betrothed. Right? That means something. That means that Bassius already went to Titus and had to ask permission. He had to ask for her hand, right? Because Lavinia does not have choice. She is Titus's to give away, and so Titus already gave Lavinia to Bassius. So I don't think that.
Then why would he slay his own son when Bassius takes Lavinia back and tries to escape with her?
So
I think he very clearly backtracked on his deal and was willing to give Lavinia.
No, he was willing. He was willing, but I think it's the same reason why. So he knows that Saturninus is not going to be a good ruler, right? He knows that Saturninus does not have the temperament for the job, and that maybe he's not doomed, but definitely Rome is, right? Saturninus is not a good choice, but I think that it's an interesting, the first sort of plot theme before it's about revenge, I actually think is about honor and how it relates to rule following, which is a very big theme for Shakespeare and for a lot of epic sort of heroic tales, right? Which is that why would he, if he loves Rome so much that he's given 21 sons to fight for it and would give more willingly and has given his life to battle and is willing to gloriously die on the battlefield for the sake of Rome, then why does he choose such a fucking asshole of an emperor?
Because,
he has a choice. He gets to choose, but Saturninus is the next in line.
I was going to say, he's
so
the
he
eldest,
doesn't think
right?
he has a choice. He's right, rule right, following. Right. Saturninus right. is the rightful heir. And so
that's
it's partly a cautionary tale about rule following, and that rule following and honor are not always the same thing.
Well, that's true, but I mean, it's you know, I think that this is still a play that was written in Elizabethan England with hereditary monarchy, and every play was written for the monarchy. Sure. So I do think that belief in hereditary monarchy was just like belief in, you know, the divinity. I think that an honorable person at that time wouldn't pull a Caesar and take power for himself. I think he would.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Emperor in this case, and then give power to the next person in line. And I think it's clear as day that when he slays his own son for betraying him, That's what he was doing.
Yeah, because once Saturninus wants to marry Lavinia, then he breaks his word because in a short, Saturninus now outranks Bassius, yes. Right? Whatever, he's emperor now. So whatever he wants, Titus serves at the pleasure of the president, right? That's what he's doing.
It does feel like it's a cautionary tale of following the rules. Like Titus,
it's
essentially
a cautionary tale about blind rule following and to the point of subservience and you know, taking leave of your good judgment to do so.
However, I'd also say it wasn't as I don't believe that the play is saying that Titus should have just seized power too. The Titus was the people's choice, right? That was the idea. The idea was that the people, but it's not a democracy. Everybody knows that. So Titus, over the course of this play, proves to not be the best leader either, right? Generals aren't necessarily the best leaders either. So I mean, I don't think it's just as I don't know what, you know, you look at Shakespeare's entire output. I don't know what his feeling is on right leaders versus wrong leaders versus who should be leading versus how we should be doing it versus form of government. I don't think this particular argument is baked in the way I think you guys might.
Well, wait, so I have a question then that's just coming to me now, right? So if you go back to the Aristotle's notion of duty, right, is that it's something that is required and that in order to, I think his rule is something like, not everything is qualifies as duty. In order for something to qualify as duty, it has to be something that is required of you and also that you're not allowed to enjoy it. Like it actually has to be something you don't want to do to be able to say you are doing your duty, right? Because it has to go against what you actually would want instinctively or what would bring you pleasure or joy. And that is why duty is held so highly. It's the moment where you do the thing that's required, even though you don't want to. And I was desperately looking for, you know, I remember thinking about like studying Shakespeare in from the sixth grade all the way through college. And they're always like, you know, well, what's this character's, what's the main flaw, right? Like they always want you to be able to pinpoint the one moment where it all hinges, where you go, ah, that's what's wrong with him. That's why all this happened. And I couldn't find it in the beginning. And I'm wondering now if it isn't Shakespeare saying that part of the problem is that part of this comes from the fact that Titus shirked his duty. When Rome asked him to serve, he just didn't want to. And maybe that's not what you get to say. Maybe that's not what, you know, maybe Shakespeare's saying that's not what men do. That's not what leaders do. That's, you know, I say men because 15th century or 1500s. I don't know. I'm wondering if there's anything there. Might not be.
It's certainly watching the beginning of this and watching sort of the puzzle pieces or the chess pieces get kind of laid down in the first kind of, you know, 20 minutes, half hour, what have you, of the film, you really do get the sense that Titus thinks it's all going to kind of work out. Like it doesn't, you don't get the impression that this guy feels any real, you know, foreboding sense of anything that's going to go wrong. You know, the problem is that ultimately he seems to be mostly surrounded by lunatics and, you know, and a couple good people, you know, within the Andronicus family. But for the most part, I think he just, there's too much trust in the sort of the rules, if you will. It seems to be a trust in that it's all going to kind of work itself out, which is kind of insane to think about. Like when you see what he's surrounded by, I mean, you know Alan coming for less than 5 minutes and you're just like, this guy should not be running Rome.
Sure.
Like, power is best served in the hands of those who don't crave it. Power is best served in the hands of those who don't crave it. Like,
it's like don't give this guy power. And immediately you're proven right. I mean, immediately you're just like, oh Jesus, the guy's been in power for 2 minutes and he's already
even
like,
get one
stealing
scene.
Someone else's bride. Like it's just like this is all bad.
His brothers, not just someone else's, his brothers.
Yes, correct. I want to kind of keep moving just a little bit because there's a tremendous scene. There's this turquoise lighting of this scene on the steps where you really get the sense of Tamara's sort of Lady Macbethness and her really getting her hooks inside Saturninus. And she breaks the fourth wall so beautifully. Only that one moment in the film where she basically says, like, buckle up, I'm gonna fuck everybody over. and it's just it's a really kind of amazing moment. There is a fair amount of fourth wall breakage on the Aaron's character, the Harry Lennox character, which it didn't bump me. I guess my question to you guys is, what are your thoughts on fourth wall generally? Because I'm not generally a big fan of it, but this being a play, this being the source material, it didn't bother me, but did it work for you guys?
Sure.
Anyone? Okay, cool.
Yeah, it didn't bother me. I'm used to it in Shakespeare. I expect it, so it doesn't jar.
Yeah, there's roots in theater where characters would, you know, kind of ignore what was happening behind them and directly speak to the audience.
Here's a question. Who's the, if you had to say the villain of this piece, who would you say that it is? Because when I look at the puppet mastery of this piece, Aaron feels like has more of an understanding of all the players and how it's, I mean, he's fine dying. I mean, he's fine. Like he's come to the, I mean, that's going to happen. So to him, it's just the pleasure of playing everybody to some degree. Do you feel as though, or do you think it's Tamara, or is it Saturnius? I don't know.
I definitely don't think Tamara is the villain.
Okay.
Yeah. I think Saturnius is the villain, but
he's a villain. Do you think he's the villain of the?
I think he's probably the villain, but I also don't know if, you know, I often search for the villain of the piece, and I often search for the hero or the protagonist.
Sure.
I don't think this fits very neatly into classic understandings of heroes and villains.
It doesn't actually. It doesn't even fit neatly into Shakespeare. Sorry to interrupt you. Because Shakespeare always has, like, if you think about like this sort of like Othello framing, like there's always like the villain is always the person whispering in the ear, right? So it would be Aaron, but it isn't actually as neat and tidy in this.
Well, because he gets a hero speech right before he's supposed to be hung. He gets a kind of hero's burial, and it's his.
And if ever in my life, what is it? If ever in my life, one good deed, did I do one good deed? I do repent it with my very soul.
It's incredible. He's just so fucking good in this.
He's a cool dude.
He's a cool dude.
Like, I want to play Aaron. Yeah.
There's a little an interesting thing. So basically, at this point, Aaron starts to play. Is it, how do you say Jonathan Rhys? Chiron's character?
Chiron,
okay.
I think it's Chiron. I read it down. Chiron and Demetrius.
Right, played by Jonathan Rhys-Meyers and Matthew Rhys, the Rhys's. Yeah. He basically plays them into raping Lavinia.
Didn't have to work that hard.
It was a hard sell.
Did not have to work that hard, especially on Chiron's character, who was very much in love with her to begin with. The scene where he tells them is they're in this swinging bed, this suspended bed, which apparently Julie Taymor wanted to represent the idea of babies in a cradle, which I thought was interesting. Mm-hmm. So on this hunting party in the woods, first of all, it's revealed that Tamara and Aaron are lovers at this point. I'm not sure that it had been revealed up until this point. And then Tamara essentially convinces, or doesn't have to do much convincing, that Aaron should use her sons to get revenge on Tamara or on Lavinia.
He suggested to her, I think Aaron suggested to her.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I can't remember.
I can't remember.
You might be right. Yeah. Long story short, we get this scene in the woods where they kill Bassius, they throw him in a pit. Lavinia begs Tamara for, you know, pleads for her life essentially and says, please don't, she knows she's going to be raped. She knows what's going to happen. So she basically says, will you just kill me here?
Yeah.
She pleads for her modesty more than she pleads for her life. She actually ends up just begging her to be killed because my modesty might, I'll die before my modesty. Right. Yeah.
Yeah, Tamara doesn't care. Lavinia is sort of taken away by her sons. And then Aaron brings Titus's sons, Meritus and Quintus, to the woods so they can stumble upon the body of Bassius, who they basically say Titus killed. Essentially frame them for the murder of Bassius.
Yeah.
So that
wasn't a hard frame job.
It's all just stirring a shitstorm. It's all just like, how do we get these families to hate each other as much as humanly possible so that no, it's okay.
No. It's how do we get revenge on Titus? I think it's very simple. He sure. destroyed the Goth army. He took, you know, the queen and her sons and her lover, slave, yep. whatever you want to yep. say, hostage, and killed the son. And she all of a sudden found herself correct. In a position of power and was, you know, in a position to decimate this family, which yeah. I think it's what that's what the movie is. I think when you look at it, or the film is, or the play is, I think when you take the step back in terms of villains and heroes, well, you know, Rochelle, you know, you kind of looked at it from a 30,000 foot view of, you can't just look at this in the context of, you know, life started when this play started and life ended when this play ended. Tamara had a life before that. Who knows who was conquered and who was the aggressor and who was the aggrieved. And I'm guessing that the Romans went into their land and took them over because they are the empire. So I'm guessing she was living a fairly normal, quiet, you know, queen's life, and she was just, you know, destroyed. So in terms of, you know, who's the revenger in this case, I think it's her. And I think if this play was framed differently, she's a heroic character. And then and then the tragedy is that this horrible monster Titus, you know, did what he did at the end. So I don't remember what I was saying,
I think a detail that should be mentioned is that Tamara marries Saturnius. So they be
essentially because she's hot.
I would like to sort of unpack Saturnius's, his sexuality seems somewhat ambiguous to some degree or another. I'm not sure. There's like more of like a mother son dynamic.
It is very, it has
them.
That Freudian sort of betting your mother feel.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Yes. So there's that.
And obviously, and casting Alan Cumming is a choice as well.
Sure, absolutely, absolutely. Who? The only other movie he's in 99 is Eyes Wide Shut. He's obviously fantastic in his one scene in Eyes Wide Shut. But I just think it's interesting. This is his biggest role. But it's a moment for him. It feels like it builds a lot of esteem for his career. But the reason I wanted to bring it up is just to realize, so that our listeners understand, that Tamara is now in a position of power, as you mentioned, Kenny. Like mm-hmm. she can now really wield her power in order to get her revenge on Titus at this point. And in what I would argue is the most haunting scene in this movie, that certainly the moment that is burned in my brain after seeing it in the theater, we find Lavinia having been raped by Tamara's sons, her hands chopped off, twigs put where her hands are, and her tongue cut out. She's discovered by Marcus Confior.
Important to note, they do that so that Aaron has them do that so that she can never write or say who did this to her.
Correct. Yes. Yeah. So when Marcus finds her,
Titus's brother, her brother, uncle.
Correct. Finds her standing on a tree stump surrounded by all these burned out trees. And he asks her to speak, and just this flood of blood comes out of her mouth in the wind. It's a stunning image. It's one of those things that just sort of kind of stops you in your tracks a little bit, for obvious reasons, but also it has to have that power because it's really sort of the main thrust of the second half of the movie, for all intents and purposes, in terms of setting Titus on a course. Whether we want to say it's actual madness or not is obviously open to interpretation, as we said earlier, but it does feel like it is it's the breaking point for him. I don't know if you guys agree that feels like the moment.
Yeah. It's also a great moment of foreshadowing.
Yes.
Like, here's what's to come.
Lots of blood. Lots of blood. Yeah.
Yeah. It sort of sums up the whole film, that single image.
Yeah, so apparently Tamer based the image on Edgar Degas' Ballerina on a Pedestal, the painting that he did, which I think is interesting. But essentially, Marcus brings her to Titus and Lucius. They obviously are infuriated by the situation. Aaron enters and says that the emperor will spare the.
It's horrible. Sorry. I don't want to like. I don't want
to
even.
Yeah, no, I don't mean to breeze over it.
Yeah, I want to sit in it for a minute because yeah, it absolutely. Is such an arresting image and arresting notion. You know, you certainly hear this is more of a medieval thing than a Shakespearean thing, but you know, medieval torture and medieval, you know, like kind of gothic torture and body horror and mutilation and that kind of stuff. But to see it so starkly depicted on screen in a modern day adaptation, which I agree with you, Phil, it has to be, is arresting. It's really kind of shocking. And I've seen thousands of movies and I watch a lot of horror. I'm rarely kind of thrown, but I was thrown. My stomach was turning. And then to have that not be the moment before she dies, but instead have her be a character who remains in the narrative until basically the last scene with twigs for her hand and hands and unable to speak. Wow. You never forget what they did to her. You never forget what happened to this character. And I also want to point out she's played by Laura Fraser, who I didn't realize had much of a career before Breaking Bad, but she's so amazing in Breaking Bad. I love her so much. She's clearly had a career before that, but
she's also shout out to people who are with me who like historical drama, fantasy, just, you know, period pieces of any kind. She's also fantastic in A Knight's Tale.
She is in A Knight's Tale. She's great.
So is Paul Bettany, by the way. So is Heath Ledger. We're not going to talk about that movie, but
people, you know, sleep on that movie. I agree with you.
Yeah, but she's not very good.
But you guys are great. I love both.
But Laura Fraser is.
Wow. I saw it pretty recently. That's the movie's terrible. You like that movie?
No, I like that movie. I like it
for what it is. It's a cute movie. It's a very cute movie. Yeah. But I only went there to say that Laura Fraser is...
Yeah, she's dope.
And to be great in a movie that you're now going, that's not a good movie, which it may not be. I'm just saying, she's fantastic. Even in that container, she's great.
That's how I feel about that movie. That's not a good movie. And also, it's such a bad movie. I watched it a year ago tops.
So my only point is that it is very challenging to be really grounded and really real and really good in a movie that and so she is. That's all I'm saying.
Yes. I'm sure that's true.
I don't hate that movie. I vividly remember enjoying the David Bowie needle drop of them dancing to Golden Years. I liked the anachronistic music choices in that film.
Now I know what I'm coming back for.
I want to kind of at this point, basically, Aaron says, if one of you cuts off your hand, the emperor will let the sons go. Is the long and short of it. They then debate over who's going to cut off their hand, which I think is, you know, this movie has some serious gallows humor, which we'll get into, which I adore about it. But Titus says, fine, I'm cutting off my hand. There's a great moment in the kitchen where Aaron has this giant butcher's knife. He's about to cut off his hand. And he looks at him like, you sure you want to do this? And Titus doesn't even like blink. He's like, yeah, cut off my fucking hand. Like, that's what has to happen. He chops off his hand. Then this truck shows up straight out of a Terry Gilliam movie with this crazy, like wonky music cue.
It's awesome.
And it's fucking amazing. And they roll up this like metal gate.
Oh, that doesn't happen right after.
There's time, but I'm just, my point is to get
because the hand is in the truck. Yeah.
The hand is in the truck, you know, bookended by the heads of his sons. And it's just such a like tremendous fuck you moment of just being like, this is so out of your control, Titus. Like, there's no way that you're going to regain control of the situation. One of my favorite parts, speaking of the gallows humor in that scene, is Titus telling Lavinia to grab his severed hand between her teeth.
Her teeth.
It's so fucked up. Like, I adore it, but it's, I just think that this movie obviously is like, what humor lies in this film is in that weird little sliver of like, you know, dark humor otherwise, like, the movie is just like bleak and like unrepentant. It's really, so I embrace the dark comedy in it, but
yeah, I think she does too. Yeah. I think you know, I think that's the Reese's entire performance.
Yes.
Is, you know, this over the top stuff. I think that Alan Cumming is playing it as big and hilarious as possible.
Totally.
I think that you're right. I think there's this Terry Gilliam-ish, this almost Costa Rica idea of just, you know, we have gone through some kind of Rubicon into some insane netherworld. And I think that it's important to lighten it up in the way, in the absurdist way that she's lightened it up, because
for sure.
Otherwise I could see a staging of this that ends in the mass suicide of the audience. So I think you do have to play some shit for Goose.
For sure.
I do. I don't want to ruin our like light comedy talking about the interludes, which are so important with adding serious things like themes, but I'm going to. I think that also so I kept thinking about the opening, right? Every time I saw these Terry Gilliam characters, I kept thinking about the opening where young Lucius is in the kitchen playing with his action figures, right? And so my first thought about that in terms of who this character is with these weird goggles on his head, who scoops him up out of the kitchen, then is the person who delivers the heads, like this, this character. And I thought at first, oh, this is interesting. It's sort of like, well, maybe her point is that what's happening in Titus is it's like the action figures he's playing with are specific. They are the soldiers, right? They are the characters in Titus when you look at them. And so that actually, like, human behavior really is just that fucking random. And it had that sort of feel of like, Shakespeare's life is a tale told by a fool. What's the God?
Sure.
We all know the one, right? And that it sort of felt like that's what she was acting out in the beginning. And then we walk into what would happen if all that came to life. This sort of random, I'm going to make this character smash this character. And then this character is going to rip out this action figure's hands. And then, and at the risk of being really crass and reminding us all about lesser moments in our childhoods, we do take our Barbies and make them like fuck each other and do all kinds of weird shit. And you know what I mean? Like, at least I did. And I know many people who do.
Sure.
And so we do play with these dolls in the way that she kind of, this film sort of feels like that, like that 100%. Come to life. And then I sort of rethought it again in the moment where this guy reappears to be the dude who returns the heads. And when he shows up to return the heads, and then I thought, well, maybe actually what she's saying is that this is the world young Lucius has inherited. I think this guy is the messenger, right? He's the messenger who returns the hands with the heads. Maybe in the beginning, he's not the kidnapper. Maybe he's the messenger. Come, young Lucius, and see what we have. See your future. See what you are inheriting. Mm-hmm. And that's why Lucius is walking off with the baby. The same way that, did you notice that he carries Lucius like a baby? Off into the first scene, the way that young Lucius just then picks up Aaron's baby and carries him off, right? And it's sort of like, almost like she's saying, I know your childhood was hard, but this is the shit that came before you. You've inherited. And this is why your situation and humanity and your life is so fucked up. And you actually have this choice in the end, or do you? Are things going to be different or aren't they? So I do think this weird Terry Gilliam character is actually kind of a framing device than just the humor.
It definitely is. I mean,
is that way too nerdy? That was a nerdy
moment. No.
It certainly isn't an accident that this character reappears at this moment. I do, thinking about what you said, I do think it puts the story of Titus Andronicus. It gives it a weight that I'm not trying to say it doesn't deserve. I am trying to say I'm surprised that that's what, because I agree with everything you said, by the way, that that's what Taymor took from this. That for a young person growing up at this period of time, be it 99, or I think this was more like, this felt more like it was set, you know, in the 70s, something like that, right? But for a young person who's growing up in the 20th century, The tale you need to hear to understand how we got here is the tale of Titus Andronicus. I think that there is a certain extremeness to this particular play that does, in its extremeness, explain how we got here. You know, Hamlet's not the same, right? Hamlet, all the violence is basically kept within the confines of one family, right? And that explains a different story to different people about different things. But this explains how small feuds can have these tentacles that go outward and then come back inward. That no matter who you are, you're not immune from the violence that happens. You know, that emanates from small rooms with emperors and generals. And also those people, because despite being in small rooms, are not immune from it. I think that there's a lot of power in the grotesqueness of this play, as ridiculous as it is at times, in explaining what's been happening for the last forever.
Well, it's interesting because you just described is war. Right? You just described war. Like these sort of smaller interpersonal or over one thing or whatever it is, right? That that only certain people get to be in the room. And then when they can't resolve it, that ripples outwards. And then you have war, which then ripples back inwards into individual homes. And what you've just described is war. So now I'm wondering if it's not also like a really great way to, because people were either desensitized to war in this period, both in the Roman period and the time of Shakespeare, right? Either desensitized to war or glorified it, right? So this is not that. This is neither desensitizing you to war and its implications and how people are impacted, nor is it glorifying it in any way. So I don't know, maybe even for Shakespeare, it's a unique take. Like what's he saying?
Well, he doesn't talk about war very much, right? He talks about, like, there are very few Shakespearean plays that take place in near or around the battlefield, right?
They're about the fallout of it, though, right?
They could be about the time leading up to it. They could be about pursuits of power, but they're generally pursuits of power within the walls of a palace.
Right.
And within the confines of one family or one country. This is unusual in that way.
And it's bookended by it. It's bookended by a war on each end.
Yeah. Yep. It's unusual in that way, but I think I understand why some people, you know, like the critic you read earlier, I understand why some people look at this as having nothing to say.
Yeah.
And there are also some people who say that there's, you know, war is chaos. War is, you know, war is anarchy. There are, you know, there's nothing to be said or learned from war either. It does feel appropriate given the subject matter.
Yeah, for Roger Ebert to call it a film without a point seems to me just like maybe he didn't want to do the work after.
Which is weird too, because he speaks of it so highly in terms of it being filled with so many ideas, and then says it has nothing to say.
I agree.
It's
he just disagreeing with himself, because you can't have a film without a point and have it be a good film.
Right. I know that
we've grown ups too.
Oh Jesus Christ. I know you have a hard out, Rochelle, so I want to hit a couple things before we need to let you go.
You can have an extra 5 minutes because it's you.
Oh, look
at the two of you.
That's 5 minutes.
No.
I
let me go on and on and on.
The moment where Marcus gives Lavinia a stick so she can write out the names of her attackers is intercut with, and there's a couple moments of this with the film, within the film, which is... If there's something that's a visual stamp of Julie Taymor, it is these sort of visual, they're almost like art pieces, really. It's this sort of moving visual moment of sort of people in costumes and colors and sort of this really overtly outside the realm of the world that we live in. And in this particular moment, we see Lavinia. It looks like she's sort of like a deer, if you will. And the sons are these lions and tigers attacking her with this aggressive sort of like heavy metal score and this blue lighting and this sort of, you know, jump cutty kind of craziness. It's incredibly powerful. There's a couple moments of it. In arguably the most powerful moments of the film, when she really wants to sort of hammer home what she's trying to say. She goes even farther with this visual aesthetic in Across the Universe as well. It's why, and I don't mean, this is going to sound maybe dumber than it should, but, and I tweeted this a little while ago, but like Julie Taymor's Marvel movie to me would be just an unbelievable extra. Like I would love to see her be let loose in sort of a really, just larger than life circumstance. Not that this film isn't that, but I just feel like she, for whatever reason, seems to have backed away from this aesthetic over the past few years, which is a bummer because I think that she's so visually arresting and such a beautifully visual filmmaker. So we have this moment where that happens. I want to jump ahead because it's important for us to talk about the end of this film, obviously. Basically, we get to this place where Tamara, convinced of Titus's madness, approaches him with her two sons dressed as the spirits of revenge, murder, and rape, where we get another sort of moment of... What's amazing about this moment is we get another one of these visual sort of situations where we were in sort of inside Titus's head, where we're seeing what we think is them dressed up as these three characters, only to realize that they're outside his window actually dressed up like these characters.
Awesome.
So it's not, which is, I mean, she's dressed up as revenge and she's got these knives, this helmet of knives coming out of her head. And
it's so incredible. Homespun though. It's like, it's so hysterical. Yes. The handles of the knives are there. They're kitchen knives.
It's exactly like you said. Like they made these at home. They made these costumes at home.
Right.
It's phenomenal. And basically,
I think Titus Jonathan Rhys-Meyers is wearing a bra. I think.
Yes, he's in a really great bra, garters, and like a great pair of like hipster 1950s or 60s sort of like lingerie set.
That's his version of rape, quote unquote. It's just dressed up in these crazy garters.
Yeah. It may have been his version. He's wild in this movie. Matthew Rhys, who I love in The Americans, and I have like affinity for him as a cultural figure. I kind of like his vibe a lot. To me, is sweating so hard in this movie.
I didn't think so. You both thought that?
Well,
he just
I think
feels
he
a little
is.
Like he's punching out of his weight class, just a little.
That's what I and whereas Jonathan Rhys-Meyers to me is it.
Fully in
the,
it.
He is the thing. He's the real deal in this to me. But that's how I felt.
I saw them as like just two different. Yeah, no, I didn't think that about Matthew Rhys. I thought that Jonathan Rhys-Meyers was just sort of the more kind of like naive romantic of the two. You know, the like. Yes. In terms of the way he came across with them.
It's interesting because like, just to rewind very briefly, Jonathan Rhys-Meyers is the one who's legitimately in love with her. Or at least lusts for her, whether or not he loves her is who knows. Uh-huh. Whereas his brother...
Well, he's at an age where those two things are the same thing.
Correct.
Yeah.
And his brother's just an asshole. Like his brother's just like, his brother just seems
he's
like
a psychopath.
Like a monster, like a psychopath.
Yeah.
So it for him to play murder makes sense, obviously, and for Jonathan to play rape makes sense under the circumstances.
Yes.
So basically, Titus lures them into his house and slits their throats, and says that he plans to cook them in a pie for their mother. And then he does it. Basically, there's this. There's this hard cut to this playful, almost a Jean-Pierre Jeunet shot of these pies steaming in the window with this like just jubilous score in the background.
And Anthony Hopkins
is so in love with this. It's great.
He basically becomes the chef from Little Mermaid.
I was going to say the Swedish chef. Or yeah, the he's chef, like, little, he's got this chef from the Little Mermaid is a le poisson.
He may as well be dancing and clicking his heels and singing in the background as he feeds him this pie. It is so unhinged. I hesitate to use that word because I think it means nothing, but it is so unhinged, and I love it so deeply.
It's the only joy he has left, and he knows he's going to die at the end of it. It's his last true pleasure on this earth.
Yeah. Well, we should also just not to skip over a pretty significant detail is that so Titus wheels in a comically large meat pie. Like, it is gigantic. And he cuts off slices, puts them on people's plates. There are people in it, correct.
Grown men.
It is a very rare pie, too.
Like, isn't that so gross, how it's still red, super red, and eyeballs.
Yeah.
So Titus asks Saturnius what a father should do if his daughter's been raped. And basically Saturnius says, oh, you should kill her. So Titus snaps his daughter's neck in front of everybody. And everyone's like, what the fuck? Why did you do this? And then he gleefully runs, like there's this amazing shot of him running alongside saying, you hate your sons. They're in that pie. I know it's great. It's like he's just pointing and gleefully just running around. And then Tamara sticks her hand down her throat to literally trying to claw out the children that she's eaten, essentially. And then he stabs her through the throat with one of the knives that looks very similar to the knives that she had in her head. And then the music turns to a full-on fucking like heavy metal. Saturnius jumps up, runs across the table, gets a candelabra. Bites one of the candles, a candlestick. Well, it's three.
Isn't a candelabra a chandelier with candles?
I don't know. Either way, it's got three candles.
It's a menorah, Phil.
Sure. He bites one of the candles off with his mouth, stabs Titus through the gut, and then Lucius grabs Saturnius, drags him along the table. The way the plates stack behind him is just amazing. They're all curved, and it just like... He drags him across the table, takes a giant spoon, and just forces it down his throat.
Oh, the spoon
is amazing. It is tremendous stuff. I would say my only nitpicky thing is I didn't love the freeze frame kind of janky time freeze matrixy thing that kind of happened when he spit on his body. But
I liked it. That was wild. That was wild. The spit in midair. I mean, nobody gives Titus any credit for bullet time. But it was right there.
Spit time. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a fucking incredible ending. Like, this movie just goes full bore, hardcore, crazy at the end. And I adore every second of it.
Where it then sort of widens out and they're in the middle of the Colosseum with a modern day audience watching this take place as though they've been watching a play the whole time.
Yep.
That's what I was like. It's like in the moment, I'm just like, but now a little distance, that was, what a joy. What a joy.
It was the only way to come out of that. It was a bloody bacchanal. It was a revenge bacchanal, right? And so how do you come out of that? And for her to use that device to go to the audience to remind us that we are those people, to essentially see yourself on screen as an audience member, then watching it to like pull you out of it, I thought was just, because she takes you so far in and then pulls you, the 30,000 mile, whatever, you know, view is like all, she goes, takes you all the way in and then all the way out. She's brilliant.
Well, that's when it becomes funny, right? So like, it's funny the whole time, but that's when you're given permission to laugh. That's when you're given permission to remind yourself that this is a play. And I am a person who takes a little offense to filmmakers and other people who try to point out that we're voyeurs when we watch films, that we're being voyeuristic. I think you can go fuck yourselves.
How do you really feel though?
Don't throw shade in my direction.
Right.
When you
don't
are
call
making,
me voyeur.
Don't call me voyeur. Don't because it be don't yeah. Don't call me voyeur and don't throw shade in my direction when you are making art for public consumption. That's a load of fucking shit. Yep.
Did you think she was throwing shade? Wait, you're so angry.
No.
Is that what you thought?
No.
Okay.
No. I was gonna say that's exactly what I don't think she is doing. She is she is reveling in the joy of theater at that point. Mm. She is reminding you how much fun this is because it's not real life. How much you are allowed to laugh at something she intended as a comedy. You don't have a mid-air fucking loogie. In something that you are meant to feel horrified by. It is so freeing to have her pull back that way. So I don't think that's what she's doing. I do think Phil, you probably got this all the time in film school because it seems to be something like film professors are obsessed with that we're complicit in watching these people get murdered. We're not. We are not. Yeah. That is not true. Okay, that's it.
Yep.
Also, by the way, I this is obviously a podcast, but we could hear you laughing, and then in the video, you didn't hear me laughing that whole time, and then in the video, because we're recording you'll see that I wasn't laughing the way that the two of you were like howling, like it was kept referring to it as a comedy, and I couldn't participate. I'll tell you why, because I actually didn't think it was funny, but that's not to say that I wasn't like enjoying it. My experience of it was not as at all as comedic. I was delighted by it because it was so satisfying.
Yes.
Do you know what I mean? And that's not to say that it isn't funny or that you're having, it's not to correct your reactions at all. That is why we're here, because people watch films and they have different experiences, and that's so valid and so important. My experience was just that I was almost like, it was gross how I was tickled. Satisfying. I was like, this is how it should end. You know,
it's of a piece, and they have been building up to it for the whole time.
100%.
In no way, the message of this movie in no way was don't watch vulgar movies. And I feel like I feel like so many movies and so many television shows and plays or whatever are like, you guys are really fucked up for wanting this. Eat. Fucking shit. Okay, let's rate and let's rate this guy.
In 99, saw this in the theater, quite liked it. I probably would have given it an 82. I thought it was great. I'm not sure that I completely got everything that was going on in it. But I think that's why I really liked it. Before this podcast, I went up to an 88. I thought it really floored me. But this conversation has just made me love it that much more. I'm at a 93. I think that this movie is just... And it comes back to what you were just saying, Rochelle. It tickles me how much this movie is barreling towards a conclusion. There's an inevitability towards this film where it's just like every one of these people fucking sucks. They're all monsters. They all deserve to die. But we're gonna do it in a way that's kind of entertaining. And that's just I appreciate the knowingness of this movie. As much as we had our whole discussion about Anthony Hopkins and Julie Taymor's interpretation of the character of Titus, it's clear that everyone knows what they're making here. I think that everyone's on the same page for the most part, and it's a film that just feels so confident. We've talked a lot, Kenny, just in terms of intent and filmmakers and why they make things, how they make things, and all of that. This is a first film, and it is a fucking masterpiece, just a master class. And I hope that Julie Taymor gets to make more films. I hope that she makes bolder films and crazier films, because I just really love how she sees the world. I'm a fan. Kenny, all right. What do you got?
This is what I got. Never saw it before. After this movie, I said, it's a 91. I said, what a goddamn movie. What an epic. What a triumph. Chef's kiss. I'm going to stay at a 91. I think that's about what I think it is. Rochelle is obviously only capable of moving me up and not moving me down. Not that she would move me down with this film. But it is, you know, it is a little bit weird to just come on and talk about a movie we all love with Rochelle. We're going to have her on for a shitty movie.
Bring her on for something that she loves.
I'm telling you, have me on for A Knight's Tale. It's the wrong year, but
I'm not watching A Knight's Tale voluntarily. But what I'm interested in is if you had that public defender thing where if we gave you like a movie that is just fucking dead to rights guilty, if you could like,
absolutely. Challenge.
That is innocent.
Challenge accepted.
Challenge accepted. All right,
we're gonna find one for you.
Yeah,
I know you are.
All right, what do you got, Rochelle?
So before I only had my memory of having seen it when it came out. That memory was like a 90 because I couldn't remember anything about the movie, as the story tells you, me calling Phil and going, what? I think I have the wrong movie. What's happening? But I remembered, as Maya Angelou would say, how it made me feel. I was like, oh yeah, that was so fucking good. I loved it so much. It was a 90 for me and I was so excited to watch it. Then I was deeply confused for about a minute.
Briefly. Yeah.
And then I got back in the saddle. I was like, I know what this is. And I loved it. And I think I was a 90. I was still a 90 after I watched it. This conversation has me 91 and 93 are taken. So I'm going to squat on 92. I'm going to take that as mine. And the reason is because this conversation just all the themes and everything. But the thing that really kept it there for me, put it there originally and kept it there, is that it is both, it's genius in the way that it both does this maddening, it's unapologetic, it's full throttle, committed up until the end. It's so satisfying. But also, she never for once lets go of the characters, just performance-wise, just like the character's motivation. Each character is so clear and it never feels like anything they do is manufactured for plot device. I know we can credit that a lot to Shakespeare, but also in translations, those things can get mutilated and marred, and she didn't, and it was great.
It's a great movie. It's for our listeners, you know, it's a tough movie to find. It's on DVD.
Yes,
you can buy the DVD.
It's
not, unfortunately, streaming anywhere at the moment. Not quite sure why. But seek it out. It's worth it. Rent it from the library. Go get the DVDs where you can.
And even though it's also produced by Steve Bannon. Steve Bannon. You can just ignore that one.
Yeah.
Oh,
I didn't want to get into that because it's a whole thing, but he's a credited producer.
The short, very brief version
of this is that he wrote a script of Titus Andronicus with a friend of his that took place in space in 91. And he was obsessed with Titus Andronicus. So he optioned Julie Taymor's Broadway play version of it.
But it's a surprise to no one. He is a credited producer. So he's a credited producer.
And then later in his political career, got to live out Titus Andronicus.
I was just
going to
say, it's just surprise no one that he loves Titus Andronicus. Next week, we are doing a film that no one, I'm sure, has watched or cares about. But it's a fun movie. It's a fun episode.
It's a bad movie. It's more like Steve Bannon's political career, this movie.
Wait, I have to say one other thing, which is given that it's 2021 and everything that has happened in the last 18 months and historically in general, we did not tackle the themes of very present in Shakespeare and many plays of his time, of Aaron being a Moor and the really overt just racism in it. And we didn't tackle that. And I just, we're not going to tackle it now because we would do it properly, but just also want to say that it's worthy to note that that was not lost on any of us, certainly, and should be taken seriously by any viewer and is ripe for exploration.
Agreed. Next week, we're doing a movie called The Very Thought of You, which stars Monica Potter and Joseph Fiennes with our past and future guest, Clay Keller, the co-creator of the Screen Drafts podcast and number one Monica Potter fan. He's coming on to talk about that with us. It's a great episode. It's a bad movie. But, Rochelle, more importantly,
it's available on Paramount Plus. Go watch
it.
Paramount Plus, my favorite streaming app.
Anyway, yes, support Paramount Plus. Rochelle, thank you so much for coming on and talking about Titus with us.
Of course. Thank you. And I look forward to coming back to make you love whatever piece of crap you pick out for me.
I'm on Grouchland.
I'm going to send you the list. It's going to be amazing. And we can't wait. Thank you so much, Rochelle.
Lots of love.
One last thing, please rate, review, and subscribe. Speaking of subscribing, check out our Patreon on all the best films of 1989, Batman, When Harry Met Sally, Fabulous Baker Boys, Indiana Jones and the Last Crusade, Ghostbusters 2, Field of Dreams, Major League, and many, many more. We are covering all the best films of 1989 with amazing guests like Joanna Robinson, Liz Hanna, Hunter Covington, Brian Cogman, David Iserson, and many, many more. All your favorite guests from our 1999 podcast are coming on to the 1989 Patreon. You can sign up for it at patreon.com/podcastlikeit's1989. For only $5, you get access to all of these awesome episodes. And for a few bucks more, you get video of our 1999 episodes as well. Plus, there are other very cool tiers too, where you can even be a guest on our podcast. Also, please check out our Reddit as well at reddit.com/podcastlikeits. We're also on Twitter at podcastlikeits. We're also on Instagram at podcastlikeits. Thank you to Ernie and Will for producing our episode, Sullivan for our social media, Jan Katas for our artwork and theme songs, and most of all, thank you all for listening.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.